Well, with that being said, why don't you make your way to the Gospel of Luke this morning. We're going to continue in our sermon series. The Gospel of Luke will be in chapter 12. Luke chapter 12. As you're turning there, when was the last time you expected the return of Christ? Anticipated, longed for the second coming of Christ. When you preach the gospel to yourself, is the return of Christ in that little sermon? This is one of the reasons I love the creeds. Often we can individualize the gospel and end with Jesus died for my sins. Which is awesome. Praise God for that. But there's so much more to the gospel than that. For instance, the Apostles' Creed reminds us that Jesus was crucified, died, and was buried. He descended to the dead. The third day he rose again from the dead. He ascended to heaven and is seated at the right hand of God the Father Almighty, like we read this morning in the New City Catechism. From there he will come to judge the living and the dead. He will come to judge the living and the dead. When the Puritan Jonathan Edwards was just 19 years old, he penned his resolutions. He ended with 17, or he ended with 70 of them. And they're so encouraging. Just a warning, very convicting, but you can find them online. I would encourage you to read them. But I love number 19. It says, resolved never to do anything which I should be afraid to do if I expected it would not be above an hour before I should hear the last trumpet. What would you do today if Christ was coming back tonight? How would you live if at 6 p.m. Jesus was going to knock on your door? Have you ever thought like that? Do you live in expectation for his return? Was Jonathan Edwards just built differently? Yeah, but is this the call for every Christian? To live in expectation for the return, the second coming of King Jesus. Well, in our passage this morning, I think Jesus wants to show us, Redemption Parker, that living the good life, which is what we want to live, right? We all are seeking the good life, but living the good life and living in expectation of his return are one and the same. If you're not already there, open those Bibles to Luke chapter 12. We'll pick it up in verse 35 this morning. Jesus has just told his disciples, with a large crowd listening in, to seek first. Or you can even translate that, seek only his kingdom. Now he's going to show them what seeking his kingdom looks like in real time. Look with me at verse 35. Jesus speaking says, be dressed and ready for service, and keep your lamps burning like servants waiting for their master to return from a wedding banquet, so that when he comes and knocks, they can immediately open the door for him. It will be good for those servants whose master finds them watching when he comes. Verse 38, it will be good for those servants whose master finds them ready, even if he comes in the middle of the night or toward daybreak. Jesus is going to give us three parables this morning. This is parable number one, but all three of these are very much interconnected. He says, here's what seeking my kingdom looks like. And then he paints a picture. Jesus, the master storyteller, knows that a good story can get his point deep into the heart of man, not easily to be forgotten. He wants to give them here a lesson in eschatology, the end times. He wants their eyes fixed on the second coming of Christ and on Judgment Day. And so he says, sit down, fellas, it's story time. He says, picture this. Your master is heading out. He's going to a wedding. And in the ancient world, these wedding banquets, they would last days, often up to a week. Jesus is saying the servants, or even a better translation for this word here, slaves, have no idea when their master is coming home. They don't know the day. They certainly don't know the hour. He could come home tonight at midnight. He could come home tomorrow at 4 a.m. And when he knocks, will the slaves be ready? Be dressed for service? Have their lamps burning? Our passage says, waiting for their master. But it could be translated, expecting their master's arrival. Because this word brings with it a level of excitement that waiting lacks. Jesus, with this parable, is simply saying, be ready. You're a slave, and your master will come back. Don't let him catch you sleeping. Okay? That's great. Awesome story. But what does this parable have to do with us? Let's keep reading. Verse 39. But understand this. If the owner of the house had known at what hour the thief was coming, he would not have let his house be broken into. You also must be ready, because the Son of Man will come at an hour when you do not expect him. Parable number 2 gives us a little bit more intel into what Jesus is after. He's like, some of you guys own homes. Imagine you haven't set up your Ring cameras yet, but you've been told by a reliable source that there's a planned robbery happening at your house tonight at 10 p.m. In Douglas County, this means that at 10 p.m., the owner of the home will be sitting on the porch, a 12-gauge shotgun probably resting between his legs. Point is, you're going to be expecting the thief if you knew he was coming. But Jesus adds in here, the Son of Man will come at an hour nobody expects. So be ready. Expect your master to knock on the door at any moment. And Peter, a bit confused, like most people trying to track with Jesus here, speaks up. Verse 41, Peter asks, Lord, are you telling this parable to us or to everyone? Peter's like, we believe you're the Son of Man. What do you mean you'll come at an hour we do not expect? You're here. We just had lunch with you. You ordered shawarma again, Jesus. What the heck are you talking about? The Son of Man will come back at an hour nobody expects. Oh, unless you're not talking about us. Is that what you're doing here, Jesus? You're talking to everyone else around here? The ones who are here for the miracles, but not for you, the Son of Man? Can you clarify, Jesus? I love Peter and his heart to understand Jesus, but he, like any Jew in his day, simply does not have a category in his mind for a second coming of Messiah. He thought when the Son of Man comes, it's a wrap. The day of the Lord is here, and Jesus, the Son of Man, is here. So what are you talking about? But his question gets us to parable number 3. Look with me at verse 42. The Lord answered, who then is the faithful and wise manager, whom the master puts in charge of his servants to give them their food allowance at the proper time. It will be good for that servant whom the master finds doing so when he returns. But I tell you, truly, he will put him in charge of all his possessions. But suppose the servant says to himself, my master is taking a long time in coming. And he then begins to beat the other servants, both men and women, and to eat and drink and get drunk. The master of that servant will come on a day when he does not expect him, and at an hour he is not aware of, he will cut him to pieces and assign him a place with the unbelievers. The servant who knows the master's will and does not get ready or does not do what the master wants will be beaten with many blows. But the one who does not know and does things deserving punishment will be beaten with few blows. From everyone who has been given much, much will be demanded. And from the one who has been entrusted with much, much more will be asked. Heavy. At Life Together, our men's group at RP that meets every Sunday night. Well, a few weeks ago, we were talking about the topic of greed after Mark's powerful sermon on the parable of the rich fool. If you did not hear that sermon, I would recommend please go online and listen to it. It's such a timely word, especially for us who live in wealthy Douglas County. But at one point during Life Together, Alex Goldstein helped us all understand stewardship a little bit better when he said, everything we have belongs to God. We belong to God. How will we steward what is already His? Well, this third parable is all about stewardship. Stewardship as it relates to Judgment Day, which in this parable is going to happen at the second coming of Christ. Look at verse 46 again. The master of that servant will come on a day when he does not expect him, and at an hour he is not aware of. He will cut him to pieces and assign him a place with the unbelievers. In Matthew's account, he adds, there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Friends, Jesus is not afraid to talk about hell. He wants us to understand what is about to go down. And without getting into all the details of this parable, what is Jesus saying about stewardship as it relates to Judgment Day? As it relates to the second coming of Christ? He's saying stewardship is a big deal. Bigger than you think. He's not saying live like nobody now so you can live like nobody later. No, rather, he's saying live for Christ now so that you can live for Christ later. 3 points to this parable. Number one, God will reward at the final judgment. And he will punish at the final judgment on the basis of how you lived. Crickets. What you do with what God gives you matters. Good stewardship will be rewarded. Bad stewardship will be punished. Passages like this, if we're honest, are uncomfortable. We want to quickly jump to our easy believism. Hey, Rick, aren't we saved by faith alone? Yes. Heck yes. But Jesus is showing us very clearly that saving faith, friends, is never alone. That there's no such thing as cheap grace. That discipleship is costly. And point two, faithfulness means, well, faithfulness. God will reward those who are faithful stewards. Not perfect stewards, but faithful stewards, those who are consistently doing good, those who not only talk the Christian talk, but walk the Christian walk. He will put them in charge of all his possessions. What does that even mean? These people will reign with God in his forever kingdom. Of course, they're expecting his return. They're longing for his return. They're living with one foot raised because here they do not have a lasting city. They seek a city that is to come. The faithful will be rewarded on that day. And point three, those who can care less about stewardship, those who live their lives for themselves, Jesus will be coming back and they will not be ready. Their eternal, forever future will be in hell, cut into pieces and assigned a place with the unbelievers. There will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Not exactly a chipper Sunday, eh? Now, what I could do with a passage like this, what many have done, maybe even what Jonathan Edwards would do, is use this text to scare the hell out of you, literally. Try to warn you so you won't get cut into pieces and be assigned a place with the unbelievers. Scare you into seeing the importance of the second coming of Christ so you'll be ready when he comes. Hashtag left behind. But that wouldn't be faithful preaching because this passage is not fear-mongering. It's actually quite compelling. I missed a verse. Maybe you caught that. But let's go there now. Luke 12, verse 37. Luke 12, verse 37. It will be good. Now that's not a great translation. This is a beatitude. It's the word makarios. It translates blessed or happy. It's speaking of human flourishing, living the good life. So let me read this entire verse out of the NET. It'll be up on the screen here. Blessed. Happy. Blessed are those slaves whom their master finds alert when he returns. I tell you the truth, he will dress himself to serve, have them take their place at the table, and will come and wait on them. Now I've read past this passage so many times in my Bible. And it wasn't until I had to jump into some sermon prep that I noticed something I've never seen before. For those he finds alert, those living in expectation for his return, longing for the second coming of Christ, the master in this scandalous story flips the script and serves these slaves. Did you catch that? I tell you the truth, he, the master, will dress himself to serve the slaves, have them take their place or recline at the table, and the master will come and wait on them. Whoa. In the first century, everything was about hierarchy. And slaves in the home were on the bottom of the totem pole, to whom there is none lower. Here, the master of the house, the one to whom there is none greater, comes home from the wedding feast, not to be served by his slaves, which is what was expected, but rather empties himself, gets low in quite the reversal. He serves his slaves, the slaves who are eagerly waiting, expecting his return. These slaves, our passage tells us, are blessed, happy, living the good life. This one verse, verse 37, gives us a picture of Jesus' upside down kingdom. Verse 37 of chapter 12 here actually points back and it points ahead. It points forward in the Gospel of Luke. In chapter 9, if you remember, Jesus has the 5,000 hungry people recline as he feeds all of them with 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish. In chapter 13, Jesus is going to talk about a time in the future, the end times, where the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the like, will be reclining to eat at the heavenly banquet table. Later on in Luke 22, his disciples will recline at the table as he institutes the Lord's Supper. This bread is my body. This cup is my blood, which will culminate when their master Jesus gets so low, so much so that he dies for his slaves on a Roman cross. The master dying for the slave. The King of glory dying for sinners. Body broken, blood shed. And finally, what this parable is ultimately pointing to is the day of the Lord, the second coming of Jesus, where the master comes home to have his slaves recline at the table and he serves them. This parable promises that one day Jesus will return and not return to be served, but to serve yet again. Those living the good life, those of us longing for the return of Christ, those who understand the cost of discipleship and what it looks like to take up our crosses and follow after our master, he will serve these at the final wedding banquet. From Genesis 3:15 to Revelation 19, this is where all of history is headed. The marriage supper of the Lamb. Are you building an appetite? This feast where his blood-bought bride, us, the church, will recline and let her Savior, her King, her Lord, her Master, her Bridegroom serve her in his kingdom. The Master who empties himself. So, are you eagerly expecting the return of King Jesus? In other words, are you living the good life? The Apostle Paul says this in 2 Timothy. Now there is in store for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award to me on that day. And not only to me, but also to all who have longed for his appearing. The author of Hebrews says it like this: Christ was sacrificed once to take away the sins of man, and he will appear a second time, not to bear sin, but to bring salvation to those who are waiting for him. Martin Luther, the great reformer, said, "Live like Jesus died yesterday, rose today, and is coming back tomorrow." How would you live if Jesus was coming back tomorrow? Mark shared with me the other day a story I had never heard But it's a story about C.S. Lewis, and he at one point was asked by one of his students who came into his room while he was playing a game of chess and said, "What would you do, Professor Lewis, if Jesus came back in an hour? If Jesus was coming back in an hour?" C.S. Lewis looked at him and then told him he'd finish his game of chess and made his next move. We live in expectation for the arrival of Jesus by doing what God has put in front of us, all to the glory of God. So whether you eat, drink, or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. We play chess, we watch football, we eat our meals, we reach our neighbors and the nations. We go to work, we change diapers, all anticipating the day when we will see him face to face. The Apostle John says, when Christ appears, we shall see him as he is. This is what theologians all throughout church history have called the beatific vision, the ultimate beatitude. And Paul says, for now we see in a mirror dimly, but then, that day when Christ returns, but then we shall see him face to face. What makes heaven, heaven, friends, is the presence of God himself. Blessed indeed. Fear-mongering might get someone to pray the sinner's prayer in an attempt to escape hell, but can it produce the fruit of faithfulness, longing to see him? But this vision, to be with him and to see him as he is, this is future grace. Gospel motivation as we long, the return of Christ. Imagine, RP, if we were a church that lived in expectation for that day. What would that mean for our lives, the lives of our neighbors and the nations, longing to see him face to face, the slaves served by their master? Let me close with Jesus' words from Revelation 3. Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come into him and eat with him, and he with me. Let's live in anticipation for the return of our King. Amen. 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 Let me pray.